Hi, you're listening to Go See a Show, the Off-Off-Broadway podcast. The good folks at Less Than Rent are back on the podcast for the third time in just 9 months. Those cats just won't stop producing. The first time Go See a Show saw the company was with a show about a contemporary troupe using a Beckett classic as a means to a political end with Beckett in Benghazi. And with this show we're talking about today, they take on another one of my favorite playwrights, Bertolt Brecht. Sort of. The show is a freewheeling musical, that's the house band for the show, The Swifts, playing during pre-show in the background, that sends Brecht's, or rather John Gay's, famous anti-hero Mac Heath on a journey through American history. You'll be surprised at the sort of connections they draw. And now, here are playwrights Sean Patrick Monahan and James Presson, director Charlie Pollinger, and actor Tom Sanchez, who plays the title character, in Little Mac, You're the Very Man. Take a listen.
And I felt like that was actually a pretty decent start, but whatever.
Okay.
So one more time, we're going to start. We're going to go around the room and introduce everyone because, like a fool, I didn't turn on the mic. I'm glad I looked at that. So once more, star of the show.
I'm Tom Sanchez. I play Little Mac in Little Mac, You Are the Very Man.
And I'm James Presson.
And I'm Sean Patrick Monahan, and together we wrote the play.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And I'm Charlie Pollinger. I directed the play.
Thank you very much. Okay, so once again, play is Little Mac, You're the Very Man. Mac referring to the famous Mac of Mac the Knife fame, Mac Heath of the Beggar's Opera / Threepenny Opera. And so when in our first iteration of this conversation, I want to see if we can just get back to that and maybe grab a little bit of your brilliant responses, guys, but where did this come from? It's kind of a wild trip through the idea of the Beggar's Opera and Threepenny Opera, and it starts out seemingly almost faithful, like a little bit of a, like let's take an Old West tinge. We see Mr. Peachum, and we see Polly, and we see Lucy, and we see Mac, and then all of a sudden things explode, like the your American history book just like throws up all over this show. So how did that happen? Where did it come from?
Well, we started with the source material, and then from there we kind of took a free associative approach the first time around, and we're kind of like, well, what, you know, how do you make it in America? Well, you start with building something, you know. And he does, and then he isn't happy with the money that he's made there, and he is like, well, I should invest, I should get involved with people who know business, and then from there, you know, the business doesn't really work out when the legitimate business and less legitimate business, it's like hard to tell which is which, so he just goes, you know, right into the criminal underworld, and you know, we basically lined it out in that kind of linear, normal way of thinking.
Like, here's how you tell this story.
Right. This is a guy trying to make it, trying to make a quick buck while on the run from the law, and this is what happens. And then when we did it, it went crazy.
Yeah, because, well, we also started from, like, a simultaneously structured and free associative like way of developing the plot, because as we were charting out what like Mac's path to success would be, sort of our in was this really just this like series of puns on Mac, on like Mac's name, so that we brought him from like Mac and Old McDonald's, Macintosh, Freddie Mac, you know, General MacArthur.
Senator
McCarthy. So we brought it through all of that. You know, so obviously it was structured because we wouldn't have just pulled Max, who people hadn't heard of. But it was kind of free associative in that way, too, or, you know, based in this, like, pun. We're trying to reclaim the pun.
But I also want to make sure we get on, like, what you'd said before, Sean, because that was really interesting. Like, why this play?
Oh, yeah, well, Beggar's Opera is a really incredible play, and what it did with its audience in 1728, I think, is really close to what, like, Less Than Rent, what our aesthetic is trying to do, and James and I were talking about what would be a great show to adapt for Less Than Rent's 10th production, And so we started talking about Beggar's Opera, and then we got together over a long weekend and spent 36 hours charting out the play and charting out American history, American culture. A lot of post-it notes involved in
which
that process.
Yeah. Apparently still all over James's apartment.
Yes.
Which is awesome. So this is such a... It's just so wide, the scope of it. I mean, everything from... There are references in there that I could hear members of the audience not quite getting because they were a little bit younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting because, like, I'm certainly not an old man, but I'm not fresh out of college either. So it was like, wow, okay, these guys obviously did a little bit of homework and, like, are getting... There was a lot of good stuff in there, I guess. Like, so there was so much. So, Charlie, to direct something like this, to, like... This is, not only are you dealing with the history of the gay and the history of the Brecht, you're also dealing with the history of America as told through the lens of two maniacal 36-hour sleep-deprived playwrights as they, like, make this rhizomatic structure of America and put it onto the Beggar's Opera. So what was that like?
It was fun. I mean, it was a constant process of discovery for me, and this constant process of kind of anything could be the thing. There's no necessarily wrong answer here, and having that kind of extreme openness in rehearsal, I think, was sort of, you know, the way I came into it, because that, you know, I think that's what the script calls for. And I mean, when I read the script, it reminded me of, like, you know, like you're saying, this sort of vomited American history textbook. To me, I thought of it as like a wax museum of American history, but I wanted to make sure it was like the wax was kind of melting, and you're not looking at like the, you know, you're not looking at like the pretty characters in the wax museum. You're looking at the fact that it's wax, and why is there a museum in the first place, and those type of issues that Brecht deals with in the first place.
And so, why is Ethel Rosenberg standing next to Richard Nixon? Yeah,
exactly. And it's like, for me, immediately it was, I didn't want the actors to be doing, you know, clear imitations of these characters. I wanted them to be, you know, sort of quoting them or kind of referencing them, but really not going too far in terms of their, you know, the dramaturgical aspects of these sort of historical figures. Because I wanted people to, you know, I was just trying to kind of follow in that the canon of Brecht and focus in on, you know, what is the bigger picture here? Right. What are we really looking at? And the more that you sort of stop paying attention to, you know, the plot, or, you know, oh, it's Ethel Rosenberg, and you start paying attention to, you know, what is this all about? What is, like, what does this sort of, like, American landscape even mean? Like, you know, where, you know, those types of kind of, like, questions that, you know, hold an audience at arm's length and make them think a little bit more, are, you know, that's what I was sort of looking for.
It's really interesting because, like, you think of, like, the whole idea of the street scene and what happens when you put up Reagan and say, like, don't play Reagan, show Reagan-ness. And you had those great moments when he stepped away from things and said no. Those was a really beautiful moment. Like, for me as an audience member, like, I really enjoyed that. So, but I like that, just kind of bring it back. Like, by just showing that sense of Reagan-ness, it's then perfectly fine to have Ronald Reagan talking to Joe DiMaggio and talking to, like, all the other characters that you had in here, and seeing what those representations, when you take up those ideals and put them up, like, it's like post-it notes of these characters, and, like, what happens if you start hitting them against each other.
Exactly, because I think when, like, people study American history, or certainly when I studied American history in college, it's easy to try to figure, you crave the rules, you want to know, you know, what does this mean, what are the answers, like, you know, what's the explanation of everything? And I wanted to try to kind of set up what people thought might be rules, and then continue to break them. It's like, suddenly someone's wearing a Halloween mask, but someone else isn't, and someone's in full costume, and someone's, you know, not at all. So it's like, every time you think that you know the vocabulary of the show, I wanted to kind of break my own rules a little bit. Because to me, that's how I feel like, you know, if you actually look into the history of America, it doesn't actually make sense. It's kind of nonsense. And so I was doing my best to capture that in, you know, in the most theatrical way I could think of.
Well, it's super fun to watch. And it was super fun to watch you.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you.
I would nerd out on this because, like, I'm sort of a political junkie, like recovered political junkie, and I love Brecht. and I love this play, and I just did it a couple years ago, so like super fresh in my mind, and I'm here watching your Mac and thinking like, how does this, like, okay, that sort of fits into the Threepenny that I know, but you know, I know like the Finkel translation, I don't know as it's seen through these gentlemen's eyes. So like, what was your relationship to like building this play and playing such an iconic character, but when, oh god, this is so like, so Brechtian, like, it's, you're not playing that iconic character, of course, like, it's a different Mac.
Well, it helps that I've never seen the Threepenny Opera.
Had you read it or had any experience?
Well, I have, it's been assigned to me many times in college courses.
And you just,
I skipped that one.
That's how
so I think that helps.
I know how that goes.
That helps a lot in terms of, like, this is just another role for me. I don't really have to worry about playing McKeith or any of that. I don't even know what that means. What is Mac the Knife? I've heard it once.
I was gonna say, you know Mac the Knife.
I've heard it.
There's some great versions of that. I'm gonna hook you up.
Yeah, I've heard the Danny Kaye, right? That's the guy, one of the guys.
Bobby Darin.
Who's Danny? Is Danny Kaye a person?
Danny Kaye's wonderful actor and singer. Yeah, but he didn't do Mac the Knife.
Darren Sinatra did one too.
Right. Everybody's done. Awesome.
But yeah, I really have no sense of that at all. I'm just doing my best with the part that I was given.
It makes for a very different Mac in a good way, in a way that seems to kind of fit this style of the show. It's almost like, I would love to ask you, I'm kind of a little grad school about this, so I'm really sorry if this is boring, just like take it in a totally different direction. But
sure.
Like, what is the agency of McKeith in this, of your Mac in this show? Like, it feels like everything happens to him. Mac's almost like Forrest Gump through this thing. Like, everything's happening to him.
It's kind of a Coen Brothers character.
Yeah, in a very, very much so. So, like, what was that like as an actor to be, like, when could you assert yourself?
As an actor, trying to, like, do something in the show was, I had to find out what that meant, and for me that meant finding success. So the moments where I latch onto an idea, as opposed to asking a question about it, are like those when I'm like, I'm in, or I'll do this, or let's go, or those are they're small moments, but they're there, as opposed to me just asking, what's going on? Who's there? What is this? And that's the stuff happening to me. So my agency is Mac is always trying, and I think that's his like big verb. That's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's always trying, and as soon as he finds anything, an idea, he's with it 110%. So that's the Mac I was trying to do, which is tiring as an actor. You're always looking for something on stage, like from everyone.
Yeah, that was the first thing I heard you say after the show. Was like, well, somebody asked you how it went, and you're like, well, I'm exhausted. So hopefully that means something went right.
Right. Yeah, because I spend 2 hours on stage just like looking and asking and trying to find an answer and not really getting one. Spoiler alert.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the great thing about this is that it's spoiled in the sense of, I mean, if you know Threepenny at all or know The Beggar's Opera, you sort of know, sort of. I would advise a listener that you really have no clue what you're stepping into, because I certainly didn't. Right from the first introduction that we get to the show, was that our narrator characters, were they a part of your script, or were they an invention of the show or the production?
They're in the script.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Taylor and Jonathan, as our house band, the Swifts, was something that we stuck with from the very beginning.
It's a nice sort
of
bridge.
It kind of ties it together, yeah.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I mean, Taylor Swift being, you know, a contemporary American icon in a lot of ways of American-ness. And then Jonathan Swift as not only the man who inspired The Beggar's Opera by coming up with the idea of the Newgate Pastoral, but then also as the writer of Gulliver's Travels, which is another, it's another material that we sort of sourced from in this.
Yeah, we were drawing, you know, also from Swift and also from Voltaire and, you know, a bunch of other things that I feel like is kind of unnecessary to go into, because they're all the same. They're all like that adventure, story. Taylor was kind of this idea of like, how do we get the music where we want it to be? Mm-hmm. Like, in addition to her Americanness, we always wanted it to be kind of like this like country western version of Mac's story. You know, we wanted to start in the Wild West, and we wanted to let the audience know right off the bat that it was going to be anachronistic and weird, and to not search too hard for meaning. And, you know, when your narrator's Taylor Swift, like, immediately, there's, like, that flag to you. You're like, okay, well, I probably shouldn't be looking for literal meaning. And then, over the course of the play, we continue to dare you to not care about the literal meaning. And I think that a lot of the struggle of the piece is between the audience and the play itself, just like Brecht would have wanted. Audience is looking for meaning, and the play tells you over and over again, there isn't any. And then at the end, the play, spoiler alert, the play declaratively says, there is nothing. You work, you question, you search, and then you die. And that is, you know, that's all there is. And it's kind of like the only resolution for a play in which the audience and the play have been in conversation about meaning and true understanding.
And that mode also comes right from the, like, original Beggar's Opera source material, because the idea to have, like, two narrators comes from Beggar's Opera, where there's the beggar and the player, and in the end of the play, they save McKeith entirely arbitrarily, and they just abandon the plot and say, like, oh, even though he was about to be hanged the moment before, now it's his wedding to Polly, enjoy. And that, it was a kind of, like, meaningless, you know, statement that they were making. They were sort of taking the audience on a ride and then, like, kicking them out of the car. And so we started trying to find a way that we could do that in a postmodern way, I guess.
It's a hell of a ride. It's super fun to watch, so thank you all.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Any final thoughts you want to share? Like,
do you have any other questions? Rick? You know, if you want to geek out, you know.
Oh man, I think any the two listeners that I have to the podcast would turn it off right now if I kept geeking out.
Okay,
just kidding. I know this.
But if you want to call us anytime, hang out.
Yeah. You know? Oh yeah, dude. Trust me. Like, having a beer with you guys, like, I'm sure I would love to hear, like, all the stuff that you guys went into making this, because it's. Yeah. It was a lot of fun to watch. Thank you.
Thank
you very much. So, we're at, like I said, oh, maybe I said it in the first one, so maybe folks haven't heard it yet. We're in Eris's office at Horse Trade, so which means that the show is in the Crane. And when do you close?
The 27th.
We're through the 27th of April, and performance can be found, like, in tickets and all, are on the
lessthanrent.org.
I thought I'd remember that. Awesome. Okay. So, and if you want to come geek out with the Less Than Rap folks, you know, bring your copy of Threepenny and, you know, nerd out.
And there's also beer.
Brecht wouldn't want it any other way.
If you could bring your copy so I could read it.
Amazing. And I'm a big fan of, like, whenever somebody mentions, like, you know, yeah, we've got beer. I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, Brecht said you should be smoking through the show. Like, don't smoke. Smoking's bad for you. Drink through the show, however. Have a beer.
Certainly. Drinking is great for you. Yeah.
It's true. We're all sitting around with beers as we record this. So thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sean, Charlie, James, and Tom, for hanging out after the show to chat. And thanks, Eris, for letting us crash your office. There are just three more chances from the posting of this episode to catch Little Mac, Little Mac, You're the Very Man. Tonight, Friday, April 25th at 7 p.m. Tomorrow, Saturday, April 26th at 7 p.m. And Sunday, April 27th at 2 p.m. Tickets and more information are available at lessthanrent.org. Thanks to you for listening into the podcast. If you dig it, please like it on Facebook, facebook.com/GoSeeAShow. Follow at GoSeeAShow on Twitter and rate and or comment on the show's iTunes page. Go See a Show is supported by the 133rd Street Arts Center, a unique performance space in Harlem featuring a 70-seat black box theater, a flexible mixed-use lab space, lighting, prop, and costume rental, and more. The spaces are available for rent for performances or rehearsals at some of the most reasonable rates on the Isle of Manhattan. So if your company or project is looking for space, get in touch with me. You can contact me with questions about the 133rd Street Arts Center, along with any comments, suggestions, praise, or complaints by email. Robbie, R-O-B-B-Y, at GoSeeAShowPodcast.com. Until next time, go see a show.
I have so much fun doing these.
We caught it right off the bat.
Yeah, thanks for doing this again.
Yeah,
really,
of course.
Appreciate it.